Hey everybody, welcome to a special extra edition of Just for Variety. Today is April 6th, 2024. I'm your host, Mark Malkin. My guest today is George MacKay, best known for his role in Sam Mendes' Oscar-winning 1917. MacKay is now receiving rave reviews for his work in Femme. The 32-year-old British actor plays Preston, a violent, muscled, and tattooed thug who is also deeply in the closet. Nathan Stewart Jarrett co-stars as Jules, a drag queen who Preston gay bashes. The film follows the two men as Jules hatches a plan for revenge by starting a sexual relationship with an unsuspecting Preston. I caught up with MacKay recently to talk about transforming mentally and physically to become Preston and how he and Stewart Jarrett prepared for the film's violence as well as their multiple sex scenes. But first, let me tell you about Monkey Man. Dev Patel stars in the action movie as a young man who seeks to avenge his mother's death at the hands of corrupt law enforcement officials and political leaders in India. The film, which Patel co-wrote and directed, is action-packed. Think of it as John Wick on steroids. I absolutely love this movie. I covered the carpet at the Los Angeles premiere on Wednesday night, where I talked to Patel about the group of trans and gender non-conforming characters who join his character in his fight against India's elite. It really is such a special element of the movie.
I mean, for me, I think, you know, this is an anthem for the underdog, the voiceless, the marginalized.
Monkey Man is in theaters now. Welcome back to Just for Variety. British actor George MacKay, best known for his 1917, stars in Femme as a closeted thug named Preston. Preston is all street with his ripped body, countless tattoos, slick back hair, and plenty of gold chains and rings. He also doesn't realize that the man he is falling for, Jules, is a drag queen that he once gay-bashed. Jules, played by Nathan Stewart Jarrett, hatched a plan of revenge by pursuing a sexual relationship with Preston. I caught up with MacKay over Zoom to talk about becoming Preston, using an intimacy coordinator for his sex scenes, and more. And we also chat a bit about Lamette, MacKay's new sci-fi romance with Lea Seydoux.
How are you?
I'm really well, thank you. How are you?
I'm good. I think the last time I saw you was part of the 1917.
That was probably four years ago now or something.
Jeez.
Yeah, it's mad how time goes, isn't it?
That's awesome. I love hearing that. Well, you have two great, very different movies out.
Yeah.
We'll start with Femme.
Mm.
George, come on. Transformation. I mean, it's like, that was like Raging Bull kind of transformation.
Oh, man, well, yeah, you're making my head swell there. Like, all you had to say was Raging Bull.
I mean, but that, you know, listen, you know, I know you from Carpets, and I know you from that award season, and you're the sweet English guy, and you do fucked up well.
Oh, cheers, man. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, well, I mean, he's like, you know, he's not the nicest of men, but it's a peach of a role, you know, like... To have something, a script and a character that is so nuanced, but simultaneously kind of operatic as well. Mm-hmm. You know, he's actually quite theatrical, as well as being dangerous and tough and sort of, you know, all the things that he is. So much of it, it's very kind of what you said, but so much of it is down to the script. The roadmap for both Nathan and I with Jules Preston was so articulately laid out. And then... Yeah, it's just, and I think there was a real unity of vision as well in terms of like the makeup and costume, because their surface level and what they project is so much a part of who he is. And what's interesting is what I liked about it is it's kind of grayer than usual is. It's not like a complete separate front. It's not like a separate armor. That sort of tough man, that macho man is part of him as well. Yeah. And it just doesn't match his sexuality or his ideas of manhood, but they're both part of their extensions of him rather than someone who is not that at all. And then just put that on top. But I love that kind of both his issues are kind of fused to him really. Mm. You know, he can never separate from it.
When I talk to artists, when I talk to actors who play, you know, just characters that, it's hard to find redeeming qualities. But what I always hear from people like you is you do have to find something to like. You can't. So what did you find impressive? Like, where did you, there is obviously, I know, playing the character you like, but yeah, this actual man, what qualities that did he have that said, okay.
It's a good question about, because you're right, separating what's fun to play, you know,
right,
as an actor. But what I liked about the man, I don't know if it's a question so much of liking, but just understood, I guess this, It's interesting. Like, even it's funny you mentioned 1917. Around that year, that's my first experience of being on like a big sort of, you know, press tour.
Right.
And this is loosely related, but it is in some ways. Is what was a sort of profound realization is I appeared to be busier than I'd ever been in terms of work then, and it's the longest that I've not acted. It was nearly a year I didn't act. And actually, that's the time where you're sort of doing the chats and you're on the carpet and everything. And I thought there's just a real fundamental disassociation between what is perceived and what is actually real. Of like, this thing that I've done, actually, I'm not doing, you know. And I just find, and it's, that's really sort of sparked something in my head about this question of like who we are and how we are. And what's kind of what's real and what we sort of front. So that, but to go back to your, I'm just interested in that theme. And that's something I liked about him as a character, that of his quandary. Mm. But in terms of him as a man, I think I kind of, I, one thing I sort of almost admired, which again was part of his problem, is I like to think of as him as having quite a blocky way of thinking, that what he lacked in nuance was made up for in strength. And I don't, the way to describe it would be like, we don't, it's not like this, but if everyone has like 100% is there a sort of thoughts and feelings range, and really nuanced people are able to think at a percent at a time, and therefore they can have these wonderful nuanced kind of, like nuanced detailed existences, because it could be 1% here and 1% there. I think Preston's like 50-50, you know, and I almost revered that level of strength sometimes, because I feel someone, I'm not saying I'm like a 1% person, but I sometimes get lost in overthinking things, and I kind of can justify every possibility and I don't know what to do and kind of feel sort of bound up in that. And I sort of, one thing I did kind of, I guess, sort of like about him, although it is a fundamental flaw in him, is so blocky. Is he, that was his problem, is it was, it's got to be this and it's got to be that. And when he did do something, he invented it. And that was something I kind of liked about him, as well as of course there's a softness that blossoms in him in the middle of the story. And that's a man, that's something at the core of him. And I like that man too.
What did you learn about yourself playing someone like him?
About myself, about, I think there's, I don't know if it sort of answers, it wasn't like a kind of revelation. What, one thing is that I think is maybe worth saying is that, like, with a character like Preston, he's a sort of, the moral of the story about him is basically don't be like him kind of thing.
Right.
But one thing that
this is where my brain is going.
Yeah.
You say don't be like him. Mm. But then where, in many ways, putting it all on him, and I'm not excusing what he did,
mm-hmm,
but it's don't be like the society we are out there that's causing him to be who he is.
That's a very good point.
Because that's how, as a queer man, that's how I see it. I see him as, you know, the ultimate, you know, every queer man will tell you they have gone through the story of, you know, struggling who they are, pretending they're someone and they're not, so on and so forth, for the most part. He's the most extreme sort of version of that, of society shaming someone so much to the point that you're willing to try to beat out of someone that you are.
Yeah. So I think it's a very valid point, and I think maybe I think of it so much in sort of in terms of him and also in the story that I, of course, and there is a side to, in the kind of the backstory that I built, I thought, okay, there's a family and there's a school and there's an area that didn't allow him to be that. But I think also, I think part of Preston, there's that he also must take some responsibility for not allowing himself to be like that as well. Not to be like that, but sort of to accept. But I guess so one thing I learned about myself is it sort of, is it just makes you kind of a story that's like hyper, it's so focused on the things that we put in front of ourselves. Yeah. It's almost like without giving them away on the podcast, of course, it makes you check the things you go, okay, actually I'm putting a little something in front of that there. In whatever context, you kind of, it's made me much more hypersensitive in my own life as to when, you know, in whatever capacity you are sort of, you are putting something in front of a truth, basically. And that's kind of been good to have that kind of like radar, that dial sort of sensitized, is that the right word? But sort of the sensitivity of that, I think, has become a bit more acute through playing Preston.
I know there, and please correct me because I want to get it right, there have been stories that say that you're method. And I know people have different ways of describing what method is, what it's not. We have our conceived notions. But was this a case where you went method and you were living like him? Because that's...
No, I mean, it's fun. Like, there's part of me that kind of thinks, oh, that's, it's kind of, I respect, so a few of the actors I really respect kind of are known to be method. But I also wouldn't say, I feel like I love prep and I like to sometimes have like one thing that keeps me in it a touch, but I'll always answer to my name and I'll always talk about the weather and have a chat in between stuff. So like, I wouldn't, you know, I'm not living as him. And also now balancing things with having a family as well, that's a whole recalibration as to a way of working that you kind of can't go, you don't want to go home at Preston, you know, like, especially now there's people at home. No, but there's, I genuinely, so much of like this kind of his outer shell, putting that on and being in that made me feel so different. And it was like, you know, having the costume, you walk different. Yeah. Having those tattoos, the hair was a big thing. Like, I've got floppy hair at the minute. But like, when that was gelled back, I felt so much harder. And I didn't really feel tough. Even doing all this sort of, I was a bit like, looked a bit like this when we were doing the first rehearsals. Mm-hmm. And I was posturing, you know? Mm-hmm. But I sort of believed myself when it was like shaved and slicked back.
Yeah.
I had the gold, I had the rings. You sort of like... It was really interesting, that stuff kind of kept me in it. So then you can kind of have a laugh and kind of, you know, be yourself. But I was always kind of rooted a little bit by walking around as him, just, you know.
How long did it take to get the body that way? Because that's...
Well, there's sort of bit of a bulking up was about 8 weeks beforehand, you know, where I started.
That's it?
Concertedly. But I think it's also a thing of like, there's a couple of cheats where it's funny. I actually saw a picture on my phone. I wasn't looking at them. I was looking for another picture, like actually a passport photo. Not that, but there was like an image from when we filmed it. I thought, I didn't really look that big. There was a lot of like press ups before takes when you had to be big and scary, where it's fundamental that he looks, you know, sort of intimidating, and that is like genuinely for the story a needed thing. There is a lot of sort of like jumping up and down and tensing up beforehand.
I could only imagine some of the messages you've probably gotten on social media when those shirts.
I don't have social media, so I don't know.
They'll find you somehow.
okay, I wonder.
what was it like sort of strutting around set, you know, that physical, I mean, he was, in many ways, Preston was an animal.
Yeah, I think, you know what, and I think that's what I sort of think I began saying it earlier on and then sort of rambled into something else. But I think it's something to be said about, I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but it's just maybe something to be noted that there was actually, I felt a great power in that sort of, you can sort of have your cake and eat it with Preston, because ultimately he is a sort of, as you say, there is some, he doesn't win and he shouldn't win. And therefore you can sort of point the finger at the toxicity of that way of thinking, that type of masculinity. But there is also something to be said with, before you get to that extreme version, there is also legitimately a sort of power and a confidence that comes with it. And that was really important, again, to know that it's not just like, I'm doing this to hide. He's going, no, I'm doing this because it makes me feel good and it makes me feel strong. And there is something fundamental about going, I reckon I'm the strongest in the room here. And I reckon you can see that. And it does make you, it's an animal thing. It's rules of the jungle. Yeah. Like, I'm the biggest lion here. So
yeah. Survival of the fittest.
Totally. So I don't know if it felt, you know, if I actually really enjoyed being in that shape, you know.
You're not in that shape anymore?
Well, not as much. It's eating too much, considerately.
You know, he does some very, like we say, hateful things. How do you prepare for shooting those kind of scenes? What kind of, is there a discussion that, you know, a more in-depth discussion that happens beforehand? Is there a discussion that happens after when, you know, the director says cut? Because I don't imagine you can't just walk over and be like, okay, I'm going to go get some ice cream over at Craft Services.
Yeah, I think there's like a, I think first and foremost, everyone knows that that's the deal. Everyone knows that that's the scene that's happening that day. Everyone knows that that scene is in service of a story that we all believe in. So everyone knows it has to happen. And there's a kind of pragmatism to, like, you know, this has to get done. And we all sort of respect that. It's funny that because in the film, there is a relationship between the intimacy and the violence in the sex and the violence. We had an amazing intimacy coordinator who helped us work through all the sort of the sex that Nathan and I have. And in choreographing that, we almost did an equivalent. We had like a sort of check-in, check-out kind of ritual that Nathan and I did, which was sort of like we're entering into, you know, the zone of what we're doing, and then we leave the zone of what we're doing. And it kind of helped. It's a really simple thing, but it actually really helped. And we sort of did an equivalent thing with the violence as well, of like, we're going to enter into this. We're going to do and say some hateful, hurtful things in the world of this story, and then we're going to get out of that. But I also remember, like, during this, particularly that first attack, like the support of the crew, you know, like there was just a real respect about just a sensitivity to this is, you know, this is not a nice thing that we are kind of enacting. But again, the whole thing with this film, I think, was that helped us was there was a real pragmatism to how we approached it. That actually was a very open thing. There was a sort of frankness about like, we go to extremes, you know, there's a lot of intimacy. There's a lot of violence. There's a lot of, you know, the highs are high and the lows are low. And we entered into it in a very pragmatically open way because we had quite little time, to be honest. You know, that thing, maybe if we were sort of workshopping that fight for 2 months, we would have done like kind of more gradual exercises. But it was like, you know, we all properly got together a week before we shot it, you know, so it was like straight in.
Did you guys have a chemistry read?
We did. Yeah. So, and even that was like, it's an equivalent thing where it was, the time was finite. Nathan was coming on a night shoot from another job and literally had to leave the room to then go back to work. Like, it was mental. But we knew that we had an hour together and we both wanted this. And we both sort of wanted to be in service of each other, I think, as well as of ourselves, because it's, you know, the whole, especially this relationship, especially this kind of, this partnership within the film, we really lean upon each other. There is that it doesn't work without the other. We have to listen and require others. You know, I need Nathan to give me things and I need to give Nathan things for the whole thing to work. And I think we both, you know, in knowing that, we just went at it, so to speak. And it's actually quite a sort of simple thing at the end of the day. You know, you just both want to go for it. So you do.
Did you ever go to Starbucks as Preston?
I tell you what, I sort of told this story once before, like, but I was sort of, again, in that thing of not method, but keeping one foot in it. I was like, the week's rehearsal, I would just have my hair cut. We'd done a tattoo test, so I had my hands and my neck and everything. And at home, I don't have Preston's wardrobe, but I was kind of getting as close as I could. I had sort of black tracksuit on or something. And I was in the car on the way to work in a taxi. And there was these two fellas on mopeds had a fight, like, in front of the car, the zebra crossing in London. This guy slung him off his moped, and I jumped out of the car to try and stop the fight. And this guy sort of like, I saw the guy suddenly look at me and go, oh, okay. Because I had the hair back, I had the gold, I had the tattoos. I was all going, what's going on? What's going on? And I then sort of kind of doing Preston's voice. What's going on? What's going on? Like, you know, and there was, I could just see that he sort of did a kind of a look up and down and was like, okay, you can be here sort of thing for a moment.
Wow.
And then it all sort of dissipated. But as that was happening, I could see that my hand tattoo was coming off. So I was like, just like, don't look at me. It was like Cinderella, you know? Like
that's very funny.
We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, McKay talks about learning French for Lebet and how he'd love to tackle an action movie. And he also recalls auditioning for Hannibal, the 2001 sequel to The Silence of the Lambs, when he was just about 9 years old. Let's just say it wasn't what he was expecting. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Just for Variety. I'm Mark Malkin. Here's more of George McKay.
So now let's talk about your other movie. I don't know if I'm supposed to use the French title or the English title.
Beast Lebet. We could use the
I've been saying Lebet.
Lebet. I've been saying Lebet, you know. He's like, yeah, use the French, Lebet.
But so you learned French for the movie?
I did a small bit.
But are you fluent in French now? Because
I learned the French that was required. And so obviously he speaks a lot of, you know, quite a bit of French, or at least he did about it. So I did French at school, but was pretty bad at it and had for a long time. And that was always a prerequisite of it, because the part came about actually through a very tragic circumstance, where it was with Gaspard Ulliel, was the part was written for him. And then tragically, Gaspard passed away just before they were originally going to shoot. And so Bertrand looked outside of France, but the film is French language. So the 1910 version, and for people sort of catching on as they listen, it's like, you know, there's three time zones that we are, Leia and I play three different people who are the same person, but at different points in time. And the first time zone, I think there was more English. He was sort of like an English bachelor in France. And there's the sort of romance of going back and forth between the two languages. Then he was the middle section, 2014, he was always American. And then 2044, it was always going to be French. So, yeah. So, but I just looked lots and lots of practice beforehand.
So describe to people what the movie, because I've tried to in my head.
Yes.
I can't. So I'm going to let you say, you describe it. What is it about?
Well, the short version is it's the story of a couple who are soulmates trapped on a loop in time. And they are a couple that the reason that they, I guess, essentially without giving too much away, the what draws them together is potentially what keeps them apart. And it's a relationship that you watch in various iterations throughout time, because these people are fated to be together. So that's the sort of sentence version. But to give a tiny bit more context, Léa Seydoux's character is a woman called Gabrielle. And in 2044, it's this idea of the future where strong emotions are, you know, are almost deemed unsafe. And there is a procedure that you can have where you can eradicate past traumas by purifying your DNA. And you sort of live within, I guess, the sort of middle 60% of your emotional range. So you never feel great pain, but you never feel great love. And you have this sort of numb, comfortable existence.
Right.
And in doing that procedure, as sort of beginning to go through with it, her mind remembers this relationship of this man that keeps coming back. They keep meeting through time. That's who I play, Louis.
Would you ever want to get your... No, I know the answer. You ever want to get your... and your traumas erased?
No, thank you. No, thank you. Yeah, I know. It's like the whole... And it's kind of mad how prevalent the film has become, you know, when we came to shoot it. And then, you know, the strikes that have just been and gone, addressing this.
Yes.
And it's so kind of like already this AI is sort of infiltrating how we work, how we do business already, how we interact. I mean, you know, and there are sort of so many, there's good things about, I mean, here we are on Zoom doing this now, but there are other aspects which it's really worrying. It's really worrying. This idea.
Are you worried as an actor, how it's going to affect art, how it's going to affect filmmaking, TV making?
I think that I think the strikes have been amazing in putting structures and, for want of a better term, legislation and rules in place to stop the kind of immediate dangers from coming to fruition. I think there is something about, as people, if we kind of like, if tech does too much of the work for us, it sort of, we also kind of give away some of our humanity, right? Because I think there is a kind of, there will be an evolution of how we think. There's already an evolution in terms of like, you know, I think even within a generation of one expecting things, you know, we're not so good at waiting, potentially right. Getting less and less physical. Mm-hmm. And all of these things are like fundamental human qualities. And I think, as an actor, I think the strikes have damned the waters in terms of like, you know, our jobs being taken in the immediate now, but it's more just sort of culturally, we depend on being emotional, you know, sort of telling stories and not sounding too pretentious, you know, with art and everything. And if we sort of lose our emotionality as a people, then, you know, but that's hopefully we're not going
to
do.
And that's really, I mean, circling back to the film shows it 100% of like, if we don't have emotion, we have none of these experiences, nothing.
Yeah. And it's sort of, you know, and it's easy to say, you know, like, but we do need all experiences. We need all aspects of experience. And that's easy to be, that sort of seems fine to say when everything's kind of going all right, because when you're in the thick of like a shit situation, you go, oh my God, anything but this. But it's still, yeah, it's like, it's fundamental to life.
Yeah, I mean, it's what, you know, my gazillion years of therapy that I've been in for so many years, it was, how do I get rid of that trauma? How do I get rid of those bad feelings? My therapy switched when I was like, it's not about that.
Yeah.
It's about learning to live with it.
Yeah.
You can't get rid of it.
Yeah, and would you actually want a life without it? Because there'd be all these.
I don't know. You know, it's one of those discussions of like, you know, I don't have any regrets because I love my life right now, so I can't regret anything in the past because anything that happened to me in the past is I'm where I am right now.
Yeah.
So. Yeah,
It's so individual. As I said that as well, you know, I don't mean to be flippant or, you know,
No, I know.
A bit like, you know, well, you know, would you want to be without it? You know, who knows what everyone's been through? You know, everyone's tough spots will be unique to them. But, you know, it's difficult because I don't know if there is a singular answer to this question. And that's kind of what Bertrand's getting at, I think, within this. Like, and that's why the film is also difficult to sum up in a way, because it is this sort of sprawling excavation. It's not linear for sure. Three time zones back and forth. All over the place. Yeah. It's like
when you get a script like that, how much are the filmmakers or producers or agents, managers sitting you down first and saying, this is what it's about? Because when you're reading a script for a film like Labette, are you able to sort of get your mind around it?
Yeah. I was actually, I think like there was this kind of caveat that came with it in when I first read the script that was saying that it was loosely based on the Henry James novel, The Beast in the Jungle. And understanding where the seed of the idea came from made the whole film a bit more sense. So for anyone, you know, who's maybe going to watch the film, it might be useful to know that The Beast in the Jungle is this book by Henry James. And it's, I think what Bertrand was getting at, it's the story of this couple who bond over this mutual fear, this mutual sense that, which is a very private thing, which is again, what draws them together, is this sense that they are doomed. And Bertrand has interpreted that to be the fear of love, like the fear of commitment and and sort of that fear overriding you being sort of the biggest tragedy. And so that's where he's kind of transposed this to this script. And once I knew that, I think it was quite clear. It took the second read. It was like the first read, I was just trying to follow literally because when you see the film, the time zones and the structure of it is so kind of jumbled up. But it's actually almost exactly what the script was. The script was, it's not like he's done it all and chopped it up in the edit.
Right.
It was written exactly in that sort of game of Tetris, you know, in terms of the story structure. So it took a second read, but once you sort of knew where they ended, it actually made quite a lot of sense to me.
But George, why do we fear love?
Why do we fear love? I guess it's, you know, because fucking bumper stickers, like, you know, love's pain, man. Love is all. Love is. I'm not going to be seduced into answering that question. And
fun question for you: what was your first audition you went on?
Ever.
Ever.
Was my first job, and I got it. It was it was a film when I was 10 years old that was Peter Pan. And it was with a wonderful cast and director called Shaheen Baig. And it wound up being three boys from my school. We all got parts as lost boys. She was doing a big old search. And that was the first one. It was literally just a day when all these kids went to a big room and we played drama games. And after that, we then came back for like proper auditions. And then they actually said, we're going to look somewhere else. And then after a wee while, they came back and went, actually, would you like to play one of the lost boys?
Wow.
So that was
What was your worst audition you ever went on?
I was working as a kid. My parents, sort of my mum, like, used to kind of let me know about auditions beforehand, and they were never pushy or anything like that. But there was one audition that my mum got really excited about, and it was for a film about Hannibal. And I was like, oh, wow. And she went, no, Hannibal's amazing. It's not Anthony Hopkins. It's he went across the Alps on elephants. And she got really into the history, and she printed off all these pages of like historical information about Hannibal. And it's the one audition that she was a bit sort of like, go on, you know, show me you've done all of this. And I went and I sat down with the casting lady, and they went, so in the first scene, his sister's eaten. And I was like, and it was a remake of Hannibal Lecter. It was like an origin story to Hannibal Lecter. And I had this whole wodge of things of like, you know, this man traversing the Alps on elephants that I had in my back pocket. And so it sort of didn't go like badly, but it was just a very near sort of, you know, complete misunderstanding.
So what did you say to your mom after the audition?
Right, it was just about the cannibal. It was about the cannibal, mom. I was like, no, it was about the cannibal.
you've done a lot, but is there a genre that you're like, I want to do that? There's something I want to do and I haven't done it yet.
I don't know. I just want to keep, like, I want to get better, so it's sort of like each, like, the sort of process of work really does sort of is a big draw in kind of what I'd like to do. In terms of even learning French was like a challenge that I was really excited by, like learning to act in another language that you didn't perhaps understand as well, and how that works. So in terms of genre, I don't have like a thing of like that one I'd like to do, that, but I do like physical roles. I do like a sort of I like a sort of physical, like, opportunities to be physical. So maybe an action thing, like a really, like, I love the Bourne films. So like maybe like a really smart action thing would be fun rather than just.
I mean, how old are you? You're 32?
Yeah.
You're English, right?
Yeah. Hey, well.
Here am I going there, George?
Yeah, you said it. Yeah, God. Well, I don't know, like. Yeah, that's a big fish to catch. Eh?
Is that the ultimate English actor's action role?
Actually, yeah. No, I see that. Manifest it. I don't know. I don't know what they're thinking. It sort of pops up now and again in the news, isn't it? Of like, oh, such and such is going to be it, and then who knows what it's at.
Yeah, I mean, Barbara Broccoli is not telling anyone. So it's constantly like, and then a lot of times it's just tabloid stuff that they're just saying it, and it's always, you know, here's the English actor who's about 32. He's good looking. Looks good in a tuxedo. He could do action. Oh yeah, he should be James Bond.
You know, you say all this, it will wind up being someone like, it will be like, you know, it'll be like an American or someone. It won't be
someone we have no idea, or it could be you, George.
Who knows? It could literally be anyone. you know, we'll see.
When your mom comes to you and says, I have this audition for you.
Yeah. And it's about, you know, Bond's underwear industry.
This guy named Jimmy.
Yeah. Jimmy Bond, who actually is the underwear designer for, there's a great underwear brand in Australia called Bonds. They did a biopic of him and I'd turn up in a tux and it'd be
No, your mom would tell you it's for that. And then you'd get there and the audition is actually for James Bond.
Then, you know, mom, you've done it again. You've got it.
George, this is great. Congratulations.
Thank you. It's good to see you again.
That was George McKay, and that's it for this episode of Just for Variety. Thanks for listening. Don't forget to follow me on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok. And for all breaking and exclusive Hollywood news, go to Variety.com. That's it for now. See you later.